On a hot 4th of July in Beijing in 2005, I met a brave man in a near-empty restaurant. He wore shorts and a t-shirt. He had a close-cropped haircut, glasses, and a stammer. He was Liu Xiaobo, who had spent years imprisoned, three separate times at that point, for challenging China's leaders to do better, to allow more of the freedoms enshrined in China's own constitution, to allow an evolving Chinese society to evolve politically, too.
Do you expect to see democracy in China in your lifetime?
Yes, he said, but it will come gradually, and it should come gradually, as Chinese society continues to change. Liu Xiaobo did not see democracy in China in his lifetime. He died on July 13, 2017, of liver cancer, under guard at a hospital in the northeastern Chinese city of Shenyang, after serving 7 years of an 11-year prison sentence for, the charge said, seeking to subvert state power. The charge came because not long after the Beijing Olympics, in December 2008, on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Liu Xiaobo helped circulate a petition, a manifesto, calling for China to embrace universal rights and multi-party democracy. While in prison, Liu Xiaobo won the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize, and an image from that year's ceremony endures of an empty chair where Liu Xiaobo was supposed to be. The Chinese government has tried hard to erase Liu Xiaobo from the memories of Chinese citizens. Mentions of him have been largely forbidden in state-run media and wiped clean from China's social media. But when he died in his hospital bed, released from prison too late for any treatment that might have helped him, many Chinese evaded the Chinese censors and posted on social media anyway, in code, since saying his name would have gotten that post deleted immediately. Some posted an image of that empty chair. Some posted the dates of Liu Xiaobo's birth and death, 1955 to 2017, 61 years. And some posted a video of a Beijing thunderstorm that flashed lightning the night he died, saying, "These were the heavens welcoming a hero." And so, who has won this round in the struggle between an authoritarian power that tried to silence and erase one brave man? We may not know until history is written, a long time from now. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And this is not the episode I planned to do this time around, but I think Liu Xiaobo's life and death matter, both by themselves and for what they represent in the long throw of human history. And by that I mean, what kinds of societies do we build together? What forms of oppression do we tolerate as we live comfortable lives? What do we do with people who speak out against hypocrisy and oppression, inequality and injustice? And who is willing to come forward when those people are silenced? When Liu Xiaobo started out as an academic and literary critic, he was known as being prolific, abrasive, and provocative. And by his early 30s, he'd made enough of a name for himself that he was invited to come to Columbia University in New York as a visiting scholar. He was there when the 1989 pro-democracy protests started in Tiananmen Square. He came back to Beijing and joined them, and in the epic 1995 documentary about those protests, called Gate of Heavenly Peace, if you haven't seen it, you should, it's on YouTube in segments, Liu Xiaobo recalls how, while he supported much of what the students stood for, he thought some of their antics in the square were actually a little silly.
Sometimes I was disappointed in how foolish and childish the students could be. Once a couple of them came to me to discuss their plans. One claimed to be the commander-in-chief of student security guards. Tourist map in hand, he began to command. He said, "See here, to the south of us there are such and such troops, and to the north of us there are such and such troops." He had all 4 points of the compass covered. I was reminded of a movie I saw called From Victory to Victory. In it, the communist commander points to a map and says, "Facing us are this many troops, on our flank are that many troops," and so on. I watched this kid carrying on like this and felt like laughing.
Still, Liu joined the students and started a hunger strike with three friends just a couple of days before the crackdown.
There's no way for me to know whether our hunger strike had affected the government's decision to launch the bloody crackdown. If it did, I would feel guilty for the rest of my life. From the moment I walked out of the square, my heart has been heavy. After all that bloodshed on June 4th, I've never gotten over this.
He was there in the square with the students on the night of June 3rd and early June 4th when troops opened fire on civilians in Beijing. Liu helped persuade the students to leave the square, and he helped negotiate with Chinese troops to give the students time to get out. After that, he served 22 months in prison, the first of four sentences he served, all for speaking his mind and calling for democracy and civil rights in China. Even when he was free, he was no longer allowed to teach, to publish, or to give public talks in China. He was allowed, from 2003 to 2007, relatively open years in China, to head China's independent Pen Center, that's capital P-E-N for poets, essayists, and novelists, a group supporting writers' freedom of expression around the world. Another way Liu could still have a voice was to talk to foreign journalists, like me. He talked kind of nonchalantly about the kind of surveillance he was under. He said, of course my phone and computer are always monitored, but at the moment, the rest of it isn't too bad. After all, here he was in this restaurant with me and my translator, and there were no police bursting through the doors to detain us. This was at a time in China's development when it felt like pluralism and free expression were bubbling up from the grassroots. It's not like the government gave any signal that it was suddenly okay to criticize or whistleblow, but by that point, a whole generation had grown up that was too young to remember the Tiananmen crackdown or any of the other political crackdowns that had come before that. These were young Chinese who had grown up in a peaceful China with a growing economy, and the old constraints that had been so apparent to anyone even 10 years older were just not front and center for the millions of young Chinese getting online. So Liu told me, Chinese society has changed, even if the same impulses to control are still there in the Communist Party's leaders. In fact, Liu thought then-leader Hu Jintao was actually stiffer, stricter than the previous leader, Jiang Zemin, but that this more open and diverse economy in China had led to a more open and diverse society. Liu also thought that the internet was this great gift to Chinese civil society. He said the government can try to control what's happening, but how do you clamp down on hundreds of millions of people? Since then, the government has shown that it's actually pretty good at doing just that. Maybe it's because Liu felt so optimistic at that point, that this opening of Chinese society had unstoppable momentum, that he got involved just months after the Beijing Olympics in drafting, circulating, and releasing a document calling for multi-party democracy, for independent courts, for the freedoms of speech, press, and assembly already guaranteed by China's constitution but not always granted. And this, again, was called Charter 08, an echo of Charter 77, which Václav Havel and others in Czechoslovakia had put together when their country was still under Soviet control. It called for many of the same freedoms. And sure, Václav Havel did his time in prison, but he lived to see his country become a democracy. He lived to become its president. Not so with Liu Xiaobo. He was detained almost immediately after Charter 08 came out. He was put on trial, and on Christmas Day 2009, he was sentenced to 11 years in prison for attempting to subvert state power. Liu's final statement to the court, which he was not permitted to read out loud, but which got distributed anyway, said, "I have no enemies and no hatred." Later in the statement, he said, "Hatred can rot away at a person's intelligence and conscience. An enemy mentality will poison the spirit of a nation incite cruel mortal struggles, destroy a society's tolerance and humanity, and hinder a nation's progress toward freedom and democracy. That is why I hope to be able to transcend my personal experiences as I look upon our nation's development and social change to counter the regime's hostility with utmost goodwill and to dispel hatred with love. A year after that, while in prison, Liu Xiaobo won the 2010 Nobel Peace Prize. I was based in Beijing then as correspondent for the U.S. public radio program The World, and I went out on the street to see who knew about this event, about this first time a Nobel Prize of any kind had gone to a Chinese citizen living in China. This woman, an art auctioneer in her 30s, said she'd never heard of Liu Xiaobo or of the pro-democracy Charter 08. A guy down the road reading a newspaper said he also didn't know who Liu Xiaobo was. But he said he's happy China won a Nobel Prize. So was a 19-year-old student named Zhou.
It's really great. For many years, there's no one like a Chinese can win such a prize. We feel really proud.
That was before I told him that the winner was in prison.
Why is he in prison?
He said that China should have more political reform and more democracy.
Only this. How government do that? Sometimes we feel that is ridiculous. But we all think that this man is really brave. As a man, he's really a man. And we, the young, really want to learn from him.
The Chinese government was furious with the award. Whenever mention of it came up on CNN or the BBC World Service in China, the screen went blank. Chinese media were told not to mention Liu Xiaobo. And because the Nobel Peace Prize Committee is in Norway, China cut off salmon imports from Norway for years, even though the Norwegian government has no control over the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. As the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony drew closer, China's leaders detained other pro-democracy activists and leaned on countries dependent on aid and trade with China to make their representatives stay away from the ceremony. Several did. But the ceremony went on. And that empty chair sat on the stage where Liu Xiaobo was supposed to sit. Liu Xiaobo had asked that the award be dedicated to the hundreds of lives lost in the Tiananmen crackdown, people who'd been asking for much the same thing. At the ceremony, the then chairman of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Thorbjørn Jagland, compared Liu Xiaobo's peaceful advocacy for human rights and democracy to Nelson Mandela's and said he had a message for the Chinese government.
More or less authoritarian states may have long periods of rapid economic growth, but it is no coincidence that nearly all the richest countries in the world are democratic, because democracy mobilizes new human and technological resources. China's new status entails increased responsibility. China must be prepared for criticism and regard it as positive, as an opportunity for improvement. This must be the case wherever there is great power. We have all formed opinions on the role of the United States through the years. Friends and allies criticized the country both for the Vietnam War and the lack of civil rights for the colored people. Many Americans were opposed to the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to Dr. Martin Luther King in 1964. Looking back, we can see that the United States grew stronger when the Afro-American people obtained their rights. China too will grow stronger if its people is being granted civil rights.
China's leaders have had other ideas. Under Xi Jinping's leadership, control of free speech, press, and assembly have tightened. Xi has shown that it is, in fact, possible to control the internet, at least enough to stop the momentum that was building toward making China's internet a virtual civil society, a force the government had to reckon with. And China's Communist Party did not want such forces it has to reckon with, It wants to stay in power, and it has worked hard over time to make sure there aren't easy and accessible ways for people to organize nationally into something that could become an opposition party or a movement supporting a different kind of political system. And to China's leaders, Liu Xiaobo was dangerous. But even the Chinese government realized, as Liu Xiaobo grew sick and then sicker with liver cancer, that having him die in prison would look bad. So, about a month before he died, they shifted him to a hospital where he was under guard, getting treatment, including from a German doctor who'd been flown in.
And it is very, very good that the doctors from China have asked us to come and to help. So they are very committed to the treatment of your man, of your husband. They want us to help, and I think this is a very nice gesture.
Chinese state-run television released videos of a gaunt Liu lying in bed with his distraught wife Liu Xia standing nearby. That was one of the few times she'd been allowed out from effective house arrest. We don't know how Liu Xia felt about a German doctor telling her the Chinese authorities meant well. We do know that Liu Xiaobo's request to leave China for medical treatment was turned down. And we know that once he died, he was cremated and buried at sea by family members. That part was filmed and released on Chinese television, too, showing Liu Xia and Liu's brothers on a boat lowering a small green orb filled with Liu Xiaobo's ashes by rope into the swirling water below, and then it showed them scattering white petals after it. But we don't know if that's really the way they wanted to lay Liu Xiaobo to rest. Chinese usually bury their dead. Some observers have speculated that the Chinese government didn't want a tomb or any place where people could create a shrine and come and remember this man. Spare a moment to think about this irony, that a man gave his life to the cause of helping his fellow citizens attain the rights and the voice and the basic freedoms that too many people who have them take for granted. But Liu Xiaobo certainly knew, growing up under Mao Zedong and all who came after him, what can happen when power is not checked, when people are not free to speak their minds, challenge the powerful, and yes, to kick the bums out when they aren't doing right by the people they serve. At this particular moment in this century, a surprising number of places seem to be sliding back into an authoritarian age, with appeals to nationalism being the spoonful of sugar that helps it all go down. And that's kind of startling. But then, the whole idea of democracy and human dignity and basic civil rights is a pretty new concept in human history. And if you stay home when you should vote, stay quiet when you should speak out, stay cynical when journalists try to inform you, and stay gullible when dodgy websites feed you fake news, it all unravels pretty quickly. So whose century is it when it comes to the power of authoritarians versus the power and rights of citizens? We don't know yet. But I do know that Liu Xiaobo will be remembered in the world, if not by many people in China, as someone who recognized how important it was to try to move the needle in the right direction, and as someone who spent his own life trying. This is Norwegian soprano Marita Kvarving Solberg singing Edvard Grieg's work Solvig Song from Henrik Ibsen's Peer Gynt at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in 2010, honoring Liu Xiaobo. I'll let this take us out. Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. You can find the print version of this story and all other episodes at pri.org/century. If you're interested in the issue of rights and democracy in China, you might want to check out episode 5, Magna Carta in China. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with me, send me a note on Twitter. I'm at Mary Kay Magstad. It's MaryKayMagistad, all one word. Or you can send a longer note to whocentury@gmail.com. Back soon with another episode. Thanks for listening.